From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. Hope you had a good weekend. Hope you're out of the line of fire when it comes to this Hurricane Helene. Or in the Northeast, you probably got a little bit rainy. But we're going to have a big week. It's going to be an important week. Quick announcement. We have to welcome in a new station. I love doing it. It's over in Oklahoma. KGYN 1210 AM. We're thrilled to be on for 3 hours there. The five-state big talker, KGYN. So that's great. Honored to be there. We continue to dominate in Oklahoma. Now we have another great station. So let's get to this hour. We're going to be joined by Jason Smith, the chairman of Ways and Means. But let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's big three.
Number three.
So I've just come from visiting the border and the port of entry in Douglas. I spoke with dedicated agents from Border Patrol and customs officers, and they need more resources to do their jobs.
Really? Now you're involved. 3.5 years later, you realize we need more resources at the border. VP Harris, baffling effort to come off tough on the border continues. We look at how it's playing out and check out the latest battleground polls as Trump surges with Hispanics, especially men.
Number two.
Joe Biden became mentally impaired. Kamala was born that way. And if you think about it, only a mentally disabled person could have allowed this to happen to our country. Anybody would know this.
36 days until Election Day, early voting underway, and VP debate a day away as the attacks on the trail get more personal.
Number one.
I think it's important to stress just what a huge blow the last 2 weeks have been against Hezbollah. Iran is behind all of these terror networks, but Hezbollah is its most potent weapon. Israel has absolutely devastated the entire leadership structure of Hezbollah.
That is 100% true, and Senator Tom Cotton equipped to talk about it. Middle East on the brink. Has Israel induced peace or a regional war as the IDF is in the process of destroying the world premier terror organization before our eyes? Question, will Iran let it happen? Truth is, they know they can't as our forces posture bulks up in the Gulf. And there is some word that already the offensive into Lebanon is happening as the IDF courageously goes into the Hezbollah tunnels as they have wiped out 30 leaders, 30 leaders. It's unbelievable what's taken place. The intelligence that they acquired, the GPS that not only get inside their cars, their transportation, can read their odometers. The things that led up to the killing of Nasrallah. Think about bin Laden to the 10th power, because bin Laden ran one organization. This was an inspiration to the entire region, forming Hezbollah, fully financed and armed by Iran. They started to assert themselves in the 90s. In the 80s, they bombed the barracks, killing 241 Marines. Then they got a foothold into Lebanon big time. They were able to repel at tremendous cost Israel's ground attacks, and because they survived, they got this great reputation, but they got too big, and they started spreading their lethality around the region, playing a role in Iraq, playing a huge role in Syria, siding with Assad. Their brutality started to alienate the Gulf Coast and a lot of different sects throughout the region. They are not liked. They were feared, but guess who's taking them apart? Israel. I mean, you're talking about thousands that have been seriously wounded with the pager attack, 30 that were killed, Nasrallah that was destroyed, his body pulled out intact, but probably blown up from the outside. This is significant, and this is the moment to back them off the border and maybe destroy two lethal groups, Hamas and Hezbollah, within a year. And they started it with the October 7th attacks, and then the October 8th bombings that began in sync with Hamas to distract and destroy northern part of Israel and make it uninhabitable. Here's Senator Tom Cotton. Cut one.
I think it's important to stress just what a huge blow the last 2 weeks have been against Hezbollah. Iran is behind all of these terror networks, but Hezbollah is its most potent weapon. Hezbollah has over 100,000 rockets and missiles and mortars aimed at Israel. Iran has used that threat to deter Israel for years, going back probably 20 years or so. And now that Israel has absolutely devastated the entire leadership structure of Hezbollah.
This is huge. I mean, I never thought this was possible in my lifetime. I just thought, you know, Israel is surrounded by enemies who keep getting stronger. How are they going to handle this? America's got their back. Maybe some way there'll be a regime change in Iran and a lot of the funding would stop, or they'd be so suffocated by sanctions they wouldn't be able to afford it. But meanwhile, the Houthi rebels have sprouted up. Now they're sending hypersonic missiles into Israel. And it's Israel that's turned around and started blowing up all their power structures. While they have shut down the Red Sea, we've done nothing except block their attacks, which is insane. We are so concerned about escalation in the region, we have come off weak and impotent with a president that's a lame duck. The IDF targeted power plants and a seaport used to import oil. Israel described an extensive intelligence-based aerial operation against the Houthis. The IDF continues to strike Hezbollah right now. And as I mentioned, we're starting to get reports of the ground offensive that's beginning. So this is Nasrallah, who's been in power since 1992. He was killed by 80 tons of bunker-busting bombs that were right in the middle of a city, right next to a school that the UN has. They knew that this was a headquarters, I am sure. When they spotted them coming together to respond to the attacks that Israel was putting on them, that's when they took him out. That's when word came to the prime minister, who was in New York and just finished his speech. There was a picture of him on the phone. Next thing you know, Nasrallah is dead. The head of the Hezbollah Executive Council and a cousin of Nasrallah, the guy's name is Safadin, is widely thought to take over. But good luck with that. They probably know exactly where he is, and he'll be dead too. So this is a opportunity. Now, when you have a bodyguard called Iran, and you get financed by that bodyguard, and he finances Hamas and Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad and the Houthi rebels, and they say, if anything ever happens, you got my back. And Iran says, yeah, we got your back. Remember, they sent 300 rockets, all got knocked down. Now that Nasrallah is dead, these commanders are dead, this organization is reeling. They desperately need leadership. By the way, we also killed an Iranian. The IDF also killed an Iranian. Where is Iran? Well, the Ayatollah is so concerned about his welfare, they put him, moved him to a bunker location in Iran. So not only do I think Iran's not going to attack, I don't think they can. I think their hope is just to go get a nuclear weapon and be a deterrent, because they are a paper tiger whose population hates them. Here is Lindsey Graham, Cut 8.
Well, we're one missile away from civilians getting killed in Israel and maybe Israel having to hit Iran. Blinken said the Iranian nuclear program was weeks away from having a weapon potentially. I think what Iran's learning from all this, it's probably better to have a nuclear weapon than not. Their proxies have really been hurt. Hezbollah, Hamas have really been hurt. So what I fear is they'll break out toward a nuclear weapon thinking that's the insurance policy they don't have through the proxy. So that's what I worry about the most today.
Yeah, it could happen because I don't think they have the army. They certainly don't have the weaponry. They like hitting you when you're not looking. They like bombing you when it's in the dark. They like trying to assassinate our president, and we do nothing about it. Oh, we put more sanctions on. What are you even talking about? They're able to export oil and finance their government in these terror havens. Oil is jacked up high. They're able to sell or give the Russians these killer drones and arm them, or else the Ukrainians would have had them out of their country already. But yes, this administration is just scared to death of escalation. I am all for being wary and understanding the ramifications of nuclear war against an emerging nuclear power. And who knows what North Korea is capable of. But Lindsey Graham nailed it again. Cut 9.
This is a result of Iran running wild, having $80 billion of sanctions relief they used to build up Hamas and Hezbollah. Nobody in Israel is even talking to the Biden administration. The Biden administration is paralyzed by fear of Iran. In the name of not escalating, the world is on fire. So I promise you, if Trump does win, we're going to fix this pretty quick.
Thousands of Iraqi protesters, yeah, or Iranian protesters dressed as Iraqis, are trying to storm the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad on Sunday after Nasrallah's death. Video shows protesters clashing with security forces in riot gear. They're going to pull us out of Iraq. Big mistake. I'm saying that, you know, no one wants to be in Iraq these days. But if you want to keep an eye on these terrorists, don't pull out of Afghanistan and Iraq within the same term and expect to understand the emergence of the next ISIS, the next ISIS-K, the next Islamic Jihad, the next Al-Qaeda, or as they reform in the region. Iran will take over Iraq if we leave. They want us in that place. I cannot believe we're negotiating a possible September exit. That's what Biden, I think, wants on his baseball, the back of his baseball card. Not me. The U.S., by the way, recently killed 37 terrorists over in Syria, including multiple senior leaders of ISIS and Haras Adin, an affiliate of al-Qaeda. All right, good. And if we leave Iraq and we take the 900 out of Syria, it'd be great for those guys who are stationed there. But they also know when they signed up to get combat pay to sit there and watch and keep an eye and be able to get intelligence and assess the power structure. I was fascinated to see that they said one of the big things with Hezbollah that allowed them to be so vulnerable to the Israelis is what they did in Syria. And I'm thinking, what did they do in Syria? They went in there and they fought for Assad. They brutally killed all those people looking for some semblance of rights and a say in their government. And they went and started burying people alive, murdering them in cold blood, killing their children in the most brutal way possible. And when some Hezbollah higher-ups would die, they put these glowing bios on there, and the Israelis would take note. They'd watch where the battalions formed, the Hezbollah battalions formed in Syria, and the Israelis took note. They listened to their communication between them, between Syria and their place over in Lebanon, and they took note. And next thing you know, they were able to get GPS locations on all their higher-ups, fully understand how they integrated, understood how they put together this paramilitary force, the formal military force, a reserve force. So when there was time to take them out after the horrific October 7th attacks, they knew exactly what Hezbollah was up to. They knew exactly what bunker to find Nasrallah in. And when they asked permission last October to kill Nasrallah when he started rocketing them in the north, Joe Biden said no. This time, they didn't ask. When we come back, I'll talk about 2024, but I just do want to say to you, I know for the most part you do these studies and the Middle East is low on people's priority. But understand, we put 45,000 troops in that area. A third of our Navy is in the region. This is where our commerce goes, and this is where our chief ally needs help. And this will affect us. And if World War is going to start, I most likely would be there. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show after a big weekend, a lot to say, and I want to hear from you. 1-866-408-7669.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I do think, though, absent some big blunder by one of these candidates, it's not going to change much in the presidential race. I mean, if you look at what polls said voters believed at the first presidential debate, they thought Kamala Harris totally wiped the floor with Donald Trump, and yet it didn't move her numbers much. But, you know, this is going to be a really interesting and heated matchup for the political junkies, because if you think about these two men have been responsible for some of the most viral moments on the campaign trail. I mean, Walls calling Republicans weird, that went, you know, viral. J.D. Vance and his childless cat ladies, everyone has been talking about that even since it broke. And they're both really smart and articulate men, regardless of what you think of their politics. And I mean, it's going to get ugly. It's going to get ugly fast. And there's going to be zingers flying left and right.
And here are the rules. Their mics are going to be open. It's going to be 90 minutes. They're going to be unmuted, but they have the ability to mute the mics if they chose. It's going to be Norah O'Donnell against Margaret Brennan. Norah O'Donnell is the outgoing anchor of CBS News. You're going to get two-minute answers to questions, one-minute rebuttals to the questions, no props, pre-written notes. Nobody could talk to them on the breaks, only pen, paper, and a water on stage, no notes to start out with. So we'll see how that goes. If you look at J.D. Vance, he's had over 100 interviews since he was named vice president. He does all the Sunday shows. Sometimes he does four in one day. Tim Walz has done nothing. He's done one co-anchor, co-hosted interview with Kamala Harris there where he got two or three questions, didn't have the best answer. But I remember watching him as a surrogate for Joe Biden. I thought he was really good. I thought he was very strong for Joe Biden. That's why I thought it was astounding and laughable when he was kept saying, Joe Biden's great. What do you mean that he's slipping? He's 100%. I talk to him all the time. And the next thing you know, he's like, I'd like to be the running mate to Kamala Harris. No questions asked. But he was. So see what happens. The word came out in the Daily Beast in a headline over the weekend that said Tim Walz is so nervous. He is manic. He's panicking because he knows how good J.D. Vance is. I do not believe that for a second. We'll see where this goes. Here's Bill Maher weighed in on all this, on Harris not doing interviews and not even talking about this debate, even though she did fine on this debate. Listen, cut 19.
Also, working to shore up her vulnerabilities. They've been a lot of pressure on her. She doesn't do interviews. She doesn't answer questions. So she sat for an interview. She said, okay, I will answer your hardball questions. So she went on MSNBC. Okay. All right. I wasn't, you know, not, there were not hardball questions, but I still expected not them to be rubbing her feet.
She hasn't been strong. And you had said over the weekend, the more she talks, the worse she does. Said it on One Nation over the weekend, because if you think about it, did the tandem interview, and then she did the local interview with the Pennsylvania reporter on the ABC, and then she did Oprah, which was just terrible. I mean, if you watch this, I mean, we listen to it on radio. It sounds so awful. Even when you watch it, to see her hands trying to get her words to come out of her mouth. And then you see the last interview with Stephanie Ruhle, just gradually worse. And what you do, a lot of the questions are legitimate, where what is your policy on the economy? What is your policy on the border? What is your policy when it comes to no cash bail? What do you mean? You know, what is the oil and gas policy of yours? What is the difference between you and Joe Biden? And she got a total, you know, she was able to get by without the, you know, on the debate time. But here's Senator Tom Cotton. Cut 21.
On Donald Trump's watch, and for that matter, presidents came before him, you didn't have the largest land war in Europe since World War II. You didn't have the worst slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust. You didn't have China practicing invasions of Taiwan. This all happened on Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's watch. It's the worst administration on foreign policy since Jimmy Carter. Frankly, it makes Jimmy Carter look like Ronald Reagan.
So think about it. I mean, did he overstate anything? Nothing. I mean, you know what's happening in Europe. You know what's happening in, we don't report it a lot, but when Nikki Haley came in and did our show on television, I said, where were you? Taiwan. I said, how bad is it? He goes, you wouldn't believe it, how bad it is, and the threatening and the looming and every day that goes by. But what Taiwan has done is they went from 80% of their economy be linked with China. Now it's down to 10%. They're looking to bulk up and get missile defense. This is all happening. Now, could it have happened under Trump? Yeah, you would have had a total world meltdown if this happened under Donald Trump. You know why? Because they're going to say because he's an American president with no experience, he allowed deterrence to drop and allowed the Middle East to go in flames because he doesn't understand the nuances of diplomatic relations and the history of our legacy with our allies. And that would have been the story. But instead, you got a guy with all this experience who says, I brought some normalcy back. The thing I'll tell him is, great to have Sweden and Finland in NATO. It's great. And I hear that it was his initiative. If that's in fact true, he deserves credit. But at what cost? What cost is because they think a war in Europe is next, and they wanted the backing of NATO should they be attacked. That's not a great reason. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. We're going to talk about the economy with Jason Smith. We're going to talk about the border with Jason Smith. He's the chairman of Ways and Means. So glad you're here. Keep in mind, I'm going to be in beautiful Peekskill, New York, October 20th. BrianKilmeade.com for tickets.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back, and with me in studio, if you're smart enough to be watching us on the stream or on the app, just click on Look on Watch. Congressman Jason Smith, he's chairman of the House Ways and Means, got a lot of responsibility in New York today. And ironically, it's places like this will keep you in the majority, or not, in California. It's really down to 30 seats in the House. Great to see you, Congressman.
It's great to be with you, Brian.
First off, when it comes to the budget, you've got to be looking at what's happening in the South with the hurricane, Helene. Do you see a problem getting money out to these people?
Whenever we see natural disasters across our country, that's usually something that's very bipartisan in helping rectify the problems, whether it was the wildfires in Maui, the wildfires in California, yeah, the hurricanes in Florida, the flooding in the Midwest. I think you'll see Republicans and Democrats work together to make sure that everything is rectified.
So, you know, you have looking at this election, Trump had the big lead in the economy, has a big lead when it comes to immigration, border and inflation. But it's shrinking on the economy. Why do you think she's gaining? Even though she's still 8-9 points down, she just needs to chip away a few points.
She's pretty good at her talking points. Opportunity economy. I'm from a working class family. She's not really
middle class.
Middle class family. She's really not diving into the issues. Even her 82-page document that she released last week on her plan for the economy, she hasn't focused on the real issues at hand. And that is the fact that she gave a 20.3% tax increase on every American under her administration with the inflation tax. That is something that is affecting every person just to put food on their table, clothes on their backs, and gasoline in their cars. Once that's communicated better, then the voters are definitely not going to be with Harris. The thing is that Harris saying she's going to fix the economy is like an arsonist trying to sell fire insurance. That's clearly the example of what it is. She's been in charge of the economy with President Biden for the last 3.5 years. They haven't fixed it.
$7.2 trillion has been spent on the rescue package, Inflation Reduction Act, infrastructure deal. And that's money that they're very proud of. But they don't talk about that much now. Why is that?
They don't, because that is what fueled the inflation fire. Inflation, Brian, was 1.4% the day they took the oath of office. Within 2 months, they passed the American Rescue Plan. It was a $2 trillion spending bill where you had Democrat economists such as Larry Summers saying that this will fuel the inflation fire. And in fact, it did. And inflation has only gone up since then. They've actually spent an additional $10 trillion in their first 2 years when the Democrats controlled the White House, the House, and the Senate. Fortunately, Republicans won the House of Representatives, and we stopped this uncontrollable spending. And that is what has at least tried to level the economy lately.
So what her deal is, tax cuts for 100 million Americans. But in retrospect, if you let those into, if you let the tax cuts time out, if she wins, you're going to give a tax cut for what, 60% of America? Will we get a tax increase, correct? Unless she wants to keep the tax reform in place.
Well, let's just look at it. With the expiration of the Trump tax cuts at the end of 2025, if she allows those to expire, like she said, that will be a $4.6 trillion increase on taxes of every single American, because every individual rate goes up. The child tax credit, which she says she supports, but she voted against, is slashed in half from $2,000 to $1,000. The standard deduction, which 91% of Americans use to file their taxes, that gets slashed in half. That affects people making less than $400,000 greater than any other provision. But what? You hear crickets from her when it comes to that provision.
Yeah, but she says she wants a $3,600 tax credit per child for working families. She says not one person who makes $400,000 or less will be have one penny increase in taxes.
I would say that that's completely not true, because we have seen every American face a 20.3% inflation tax because of her economic policies, because of her and Biden's economic policies. The reason why it's her fault, she was a tie-breaking vote in the American Rescue Plan, which was a $2 trillion spending bill. She was the tie-breaking vote in the Senate for the Inflation Reduction Act. She was the result of a lot of these economic policies directly passing, which has fueled the inflation fire. So the people making less than $400,000 a year, they've lost 20%. They've lost 20%.
So when people took a look at the tax reform that you guys passed, they say keep saying that Donald Trump gave a tax break to his billionaire friends, when in reality, the people that benefited most from that tax plan are the middle class. Could you go over the numbers and how this is all playing out since it passed in 2018?
That's exactly right. Actually, the lower and middle class had the largest growth in wages than the upper class from the Trump tax cuts. If you think about it, a family of four, if they make less than $65,000 a year under the Trump tax cuts, they would pay zero in federal taxes. That's relief for working families. The congressional district, Brian, that I represent in Southeast Missouri is the ninth poorest congressional district out of 435 in the nation. The median household income for a family of four is $45,000 a year. That made a huge difference in the lives of poor working class Americans. And so to say that this only helped the wealthy and the—
Would you just cut 1 percentage point off the top bracket, correct? Now it's at 37. It was at 38.
Yeah. Every individual rate went down. Every individual rate. But you looked at the corporate rate. It went down from 35% to 21%. We did global tax changes that led to our country not having one inversion. If you recall, under Obama, we had almost 30 different countries invert to other nations with lower tax rates.
You had 30 companies.
30 companies.
Companies,
I mean,
okay. Yeah. So go to another country, you call that inversion.
Inversion.
And when they come back, that's what you want. You want them to get them to come back. And the way to get them to come back is to have a competitive corporate tax rate. So Ireland, maybe it's impossible to get that low. They're in their teens. But you guys knocked it down from 35, maybe the third highest, down to 21. She wants to put it back up to 28. She said you cut it too much.
Well, I would say that she, in fact, wants to be back at 35% because she has stated numerous times and she also has voted to repeal the Trump tax cuts. And repealing the Trump tax cuts would create a 35% corporate rate. She's saying today that she's for a 28% corporate tax rate, but that's not what her words and actions said just a few years ago.
Well, then she'd have to do a totally different. She'd have to pass that. You know, so if you're going to let those evaporate, you let them evaporate, everything goes back up. So then she would have to pass something that knocks it down to 28%. A lot of Republicans would be reluctant to do that.
That's exactly right. But the corporate rate is permanent. It's one of the things that's not expiring.
That's true. So that stays at 21 regardless?
Yeah, it stays at 21% unless Congress changes it. You know, nothing is permanent when you're looking at Washington, D.C., so you have to be careful with that. But in fact, it does not expire. The small business deduction does expire. That was something that allowed subchapter S's, LLCs, pass-through entities, which make up almost 70% of all businesses in the nation. They had a 20% rate to try to create parity from the 43.4% tax rate that they have down to about a 23%. That expires. So a business rate for pass-throughs will go up to 43% if Congress does nothing.
So Congressman Jason Smith is here. He's chairman of the Ways and Means, who's handling the budget in the country. So when we look at what's going on right now, this Kamala Harris is running on being somebody that is going to bat for the middle class. But when you look at her background, she's really never gone to bat for the middle class. In fact, if you look at where she spent most of her time in Canada, you got a beautiful neighborhood. Her mom was a cancer researcher, not usually known as a middle-class job, and they have not found any. I know Trump is all over this. They have not found indications that she ever worked at McDonald's.
You know, we've heard it numerous times that she comes from middle-class family. Brian, I come from, I would say, a lower to middle-class working family. My father was an auto mechanic, and my mother was a factory worker. I grew up in a single-wide trailer most of my life, and then we upgraded to a double-wide when I was in high school. So I feel like I understand working-class priorities. The guaranteed standard deduction, for example, 91% of Americans used to file their taxes. Mm-hmm. She has been crickets. She has not said anything. That provision alone is slashed in half if Congress does nothing or if you repeal the Trump tax cuts, which she has offered to do.
When you talk about unrealized capital gains, so taxing people on unrealized gains. So what they're saying is we're tired of people living off the stock market and like Warren Buffett and not paying any taxes. And he's come out and said, my secretary pays more than me. But if you start taxing people on how much their stock at the end of the year was worth, people are not going to be able to pay that cash because they don't have it. And some have said that that would also mean that if your house increased in value, so let's say you have a $1 million house, and just because it just happens, prices go up, whether it is, it's now worth 1.8. But now you have to pay more taxes on that house or the purchase. So is this something she thought out? I mean, this is something that's never been done before. It might even be unconstitutional.
It's a disaster for our economy. Imagine if your home appreciated over $1 million just because of inflation that she created of 20%. She also wants to tax you again because the value of your home has went up. It doesn't make sense. It would destroy small businesses. It would destroy innovation, and it would push
right.
And money outside of the United States.
Do you remember Amazon when it started wasn't making a profit? And then it started making a profit, but nobody was cashing in their stock. They were holding on to it. Now, in theory, if you play this out, Amazon has a great year. You own it. You have a lot of stock. All of a sudden, you got to cash out because you don't have cash laying around because you were fortunate enough to buy into something. It'll force just major companies to have the cash around to buy it from Jason Smith of Missouri. Correct?
It's a crazy idea that I don't believe that is approachable. It's much like the 1099-K provision that they did that made it any transaction over $600 through PayPal or Venmo, the IRS is going to be
looking. They backed off that, right?
It's still law. They haven't rescinded it. In fact, we tried to rescind it in the Ways and Means Committee just in the last couple weeks. Not one Democrat would vote with us.
Wow. When we come back, I want to talk about the chance to hold on to the House. It was about a year ago when Kevin McCarthy lost the speaker job. It looked like total chaos, a million votes, and they thought Republicans have relinquished their chance to run the House. But things have certainly changed since then. We'll talk about that and get your projections, too, in the Senate, as President Trump is in a dead heat or slightly up in almost every battleground state. Fascinating time. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
What Donald Trump has suggested to John Deere in the 200% tariff is ridiculously bad and destructive. Next in the what the hell is he thinking list is the 10% price cap on credit card interest rates. I mean, literally, Bernie Sanders suggested a cap of only 15%, right? So now you've got Donald Trump getting involved in price caps and price controls to a greater extent than self-described socialist Bernie Sanders. And I think that just says so much about how far Donald has gone to, you know, his socialist and communistic tendencies.
Yeah, that's Mark Cuban, desperate to not have Donald Trump be president again. The chairman of the Ways and Means is here, Congressman Jason Smith. What's your reaction?
I think that it's basically hogwash would be a great way to say it, Brian. There is no way that President Trump has socialist or communist priorities or objectives. And for Mark Cuban to say that, that's outrageous.
And she couldn't believe how meticulous Kamala Harris is.
Yeah.
That's what his term was.
She's great with all her word salads.
Right.
She can talk about the economy really, really well.
The one thing you wanted to do, Chairman, you wanted to demand the IRS revoke the tax exempt status of eight organizations that are because you're uncovering ties that they have to terrorist organizations like Hezbollah, Hamas, and the terrorist country of Iran.
We've been investigating tax-exempt entities ever since I became chairman. And what we have uncovered is that there's some 501c3s that are tax-exempt in our country that have been funneling money to Hamas and other terrorist organizations. We have called on Commissioner Werfel at the IRS to revoke their tax-exempt status. Being tax-exempt is a privilege, not a right. Unfortunately, we've also seen where these tax-exempt organizations have violated their public purpose, such as using their resources to help promote and organize the protest on college campuses, the anti-Semitic protest on college campuses. These are things that should not be tax exempt, and we're asking for the commissioner to revoke them.
So would it be a one-person decision?
It could be. The commissioner of the IRS can revoke him single-handedly. He has the authority to do it.
My sense is if you uncover that Hezbollah, Hamas are funding these groups, this could be a bipartisan buy-in, or are they concerned that a lot of those people protesting are Democratic voters?
You would think that it would be bipartisan.
But you're not getting that.
We're not getting it so far. I hope that the commissioner—
Like Moskowitz, Jason Moskowitz and those guys, I mean, who have been so strong about this?
Now, we did pass a bill out of the House of Representatives. It was David Kustoff's bill that allowed— into statute prohibiting tax-exempt statuses to fund terrorism. I mean, that makes complete sense. That was bipartisan, that aspect. So you had those individuals. But in regards to revoking these eight different organizations, which we have named the names, eight – Democrats have not joined in with us on
that. That's something that if you guys can hold the majority, I look to do. In the last couple of minutes, you got about 30 seats, they say, ballpark, are really in contention for the House. You got about four seat lead right now. How do you feel about – I know you want to hold the majority, obviously, but where do you think – what has you feeling optimistic?
Brian, I'm very confident that we will hold the majority. If you just look at 2016 and 2020, both times when Trump was on the ballot, the House gained seats. The only time we lost seats was in 2018 when we lost the majority and Trump was not on the ballot. Trump being on the ballot helps us in how the congressional districts are numbered. Of course, it's going to go through New York. It's going to go through California. It's going to go through New Jersey. Those are competitive seats that's going to decide the majority. And I'm pretty optimistic and proud. But the people in New York and California and New Jersey are going to be the majority deciders.
Well, you got Anthony D'Esposito in a tough fight right in roughly my district. And then you have a few other two others in New York in particular. So that's going to go down to the wire. Your polling you're seeing is what, dead heat?
The polling that we've been seeing in these individual congressional districts across the country is in a good place to be. Vice President Harris's best day was her first day. Since then, and since the voters are getting to know her better, it's only helping us.
You said you have your eye on what's happening in Pennsylvania and Maine. What do you mean?
In Pennsylvania, for example, in some of the competitive congressional districts outside of Philadelphia that we monitor, for example, one held by a Republican, Biden won that by eight percentage points in 2020. Right now, Harris is only winning that same congressional district by two. That means Trump will win the state of Pennsylvania.
And that would probably help McCormick, too, in the Senate. Jason Smith, thank you.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. We're going to have a big hour coming your way. Also, we have some exciting news, too. But first, with Michael Goodwin standing by, the New York Post, talking about this race and how there's just so much going on, whether it's in Israel or just to see Kamala Harris, the vice president, in front of that vanity project of Donald Trump's, that wall that Barack Obama built, with sitting there with a jeans jacket on, walking around with Border Patrol, which he should have been doing 3.5 years ago, and the bottom of the arrow, Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann. He was the conducted and coordinated the Task Force Pineapple, author of a brand new book, Nobody's Coming to Save You, A Green Beret's Guide to Getting Big Things Done. And we'll get to all of that. Also, a special announcement, KGYN is now carrying the show. Another affiliate, 1210 a.m. in Guymon, Oklahoma. You can hear us from 8 to 11 local time there. The five-state big talker, KGYN. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
So I've just come from visiting the border and the port of entry in Douglas. I spoke with dedicated agents from Border Patrol and customs officers, and they need more resources to do their jobs.
Really? Then why did you not give them that? Vice President Harris' baffling effort to come off tough on the border continues. We look at how it's playing and check out the latest battleground polls as Trump surges with Hispanics, especially men.
Number two.
Joe Biden became mentally impaired. Kamala was born that way. And if you think about it, only a mentally disabled person could have allowed this to happen to our country. Anybody would know this.
It's not mentally disabled. Bad judgment, terrible policies. But that allows CNN and MSNBC to go off on that. 36 days to Election Day, early voting underway, and VP debate a day away as the attacks on the trail get more personal.
Number one.
I think it's important to stress just what a huge blow the last 2 weeks have been against Hezbollah. Iran is behind all of these terror networks, but Hezbollah is its most potent weapon. Israel has absolutely devastated the entire leadership structure of Hezbollah.
Middle East on the brink. Has Israel induced peace or a regional war? Fascinating. As the IDF is in the process of destroying the world's premier terror organization. Question, will Iran let it happen? Truth is, they know they can't stop the IDF. They know the IDF has all the intelligence on them. They know that the Ayatollah is so scared they moved him to a secure location. Because think about this. Sinwar is hanging out with hostages. You have Nasrallah, much more lethal, dead. All his higher-ups, 30 strong, dead. 3,000-plus wounded with the exploding pagers and walkie-talkies. So this is fascinating. So let's bring in Michael Goodwin, New York Post columnist. Michael, it looks like Netanyahu is reestablishing that IDF dominance, don't you think?
Good morning, Brian. Absolutely. You know, the David Friedman, the former American ambassador to Israel, said something the other day that essentially Israel is now leading the fight against terror, and it would be nice if the United States helped. And I think that perfectly sums up what's happened when you went through the list of the, you know, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, and the Houthis firing on American ships, but American ships not firing back. That's not the Israeli way, and the Israeli way is, it's more than an eye for an eye, and I think that is how you create deterrence, and certainly that's what we're witnessing in Iran right now. Iran is, at least for now, has been deterred from attacking Israel, from unleashing even more of its proxies in the region, because Israel has been so clear in its aims that it's going to stop this. I mean, the Hezbollah is a fascinating example, I think, Brian, that will be taught in history, which is that we the Israelis told them, stop with the daily rockets and missiles, stop. They didn't stop. And so little by little, Israel took out the command leadership. They showed what they were capable of, as you mentioned, the beepers and the walkie-talkies. I mean, they showed. All of that was, in effect, warning shots at Nasrallah. Stop this before we take the next step. And then they started wiping out the people closest to him. Still didn't get the message. And then finally, he had to go, too.
80 tons of bunker-busting bombs. They dropped on him in the middle of a city. They built it in the middle of a dense area, hoping to protect themselves. They tracked him right to that site, and the prime minister called the shot from New York City.
I mean, the intelligence operations that Israel has carried out, starting with the beepers. I mean, there are various stories about how they got hold of those beepers. Was it in the supply line? Did they set up a dummy company that actually manufactured them? Whatever they did, and they knew who had them. I mean, this was not something that was sold on a black market or even an open market in Lebanon anywhere. These were only Hezbollah fighters and officials who had these beepers. I mean, it was a remarkable thing. And you would think that at some point Hezbollah would have taken the message, you know, that these people are serious, they know where we are. And so even Nasrallah, on the last day, they know where he is. Now, that's extraordinary intelligence to be able to have that, whether it's human or technology or star, satellite. But somehow they were able to pinpoint the entire leadership of Hezbollah. And I think that has to be deterring Iran. When you mentioned that the Ayatollah is in hiding, I mean, that is an example of what deterrence does.
It does, and we're bystanders, and they're blowing up the Houthi rebels' energy and weapons depots, yet they have shut off the Red Sea from us while taking shots at us with $100 drones while we're using million-dollar missiles to knock it out of the sky, and that is not even news these days. But Israel is beginning to take everybody out using our weaponry. I got it. They're paying for it, too. But number three is Iran is really on the clock. Because Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, all these terror groups that they finance believe that Iran has their back. And right now, the world is looking at them, the terror world is looking at them, say, go take out Israel. And they want no part of this fight. Here's Lindsey Graham, Cut 8.
Well, we're one missile away from civilians getting killed in Israel and maybe Israel having to hit Iran. Blinken said the Iranian nuclear program was weeks away from having a weapon potentially. I think what Iran's learning from all this is probably better to have a nuclear weapon than not. Their proxies have really been hurt. Hezbollah, Hamas have really been hurt. So what I fear is they'll break out toward a nuclear weapon thinking that's the insurance policy they don't have through the proxy. So that's what I worry about the most today.
So this is where we're at. We have 45,000 sailors in the region. And I imagine assets on the ground if you count Syria and Iraq. Your thoughts about where this is going to be heading, judging by what we've seen, I hear that the IDF is already moving in on the ground.
Well, I'm not surprised by that, Brian. I think that they've got to push Hezbollah back from the border. Hezbollah, under a United Nations resolution, was supposed to be much further north into Lebanon. That was the limit. There would be effectively a demilitarized zone in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah moved right near the border, and so they broke that. The UN never said anything about it. Israel is at the very least enforcing that. But to what Lindsey Graham said and to the Iranian bomb, look, I think Israel has been very clear that it will not allow Iran to have the bomb. And so after these last couple of weeks, you would think that message would now be heard loud and clear. So I'm not sure that Iran is going to race to get the bomb now. The larger point of Iran's role in all of this, I think one way to understand the structure of the terror proxies was that they were sort of the tentacles that would protect the body being Iran. Now, all those tentacles are effectively gone. So Iran itself is exposed. And so this idea that it wants the bomb is now out there because it has no other protections. And so this is the moment for Iran to choose. You know, is it going to risk all-out war with Israel, in which case I would hope the United States would be supportive of Israel and not take this neutral scolding position that has been totally ineffective and has actually prolonged the Hamas and the Hezbollah situation. But I think that's the next move here. Israel is definitely going to move into Lebanon, and it's definitely going to reestablish a demilitarized zone. But is Iran now, having been exposed, and as you say, on the clock, meaning it's their turn to make a move, I don't think that move is going to be a big military move because they cannot stop Israel as it stands now. So if the final battle is now, Iran loses and it loses everything.
But do you realize how many problems are solved if Iran's government is overthrown?
It would be amazing. I think the world would be, you know, 50% safer in a day. I mean, Iran is the problem of so much trouble around the world. I mean, Hezbollah operated in South America. It's tried to kill Americans. It killed many Americans in the region, but they tried to do assassinations here. They are the most malignant force in the world. And these tentacles, they operated through these tentacles to protect their homeland. But now they can't do that. Now the homeland is you know, in the game. And I think this is a huge moment, not just in this issue, but in world history.
Yeah. And the thing is, I think that, in my opinion, the prime minister knows that if Harris takes over, things are going to change radically. I mean, they've held back and slowed down weapons deliveries, 2,000-pound bombs. Obviously, they had enough. But if Harris comes in there, she hears those Michigan Columbia students. And that's where I think she stands. She thinks that Israel's the problem. Certainly Netanyahu is the problem.
Absolutely. And I think there's another dimension to it, too, Brian, which is that, you know, for the people who don't really understand these things, and I would put her in that regard, this idea of a ceasefire or, you know, sort of peace, it has a ring that, oh, yes, we must grab for that ring every time. We must always go for that. And, of course, no one wants to see civilians caught up or the damage that gets done in war. But sometimes you have to prepare for war to get peace. And this idea that you can constantly concede something in order to preserve peace, that's the appeasement policy, which no one would say, yes, that's our policy, but it sneaks in the back door. Whenever you are so obsessed with having peace at any price, you end up getting war. And that's what I think Harris represents, more than her own, just her own background or whatever. I do believe that is now the posture of the Democratic Party, particularly the progressive left, which is that all of this thing is all about colonialization, it's about white supremacy, it's all these things. We just have to give people more money. I mean, they have no sense of strength, no sense of military. The military is bad. We must defang the military. We must deal with pronouns of the military. The military has to support transgenderism and DEI and all those things. That tells you they have no sense of what a military is for. It's not just another social service agency.
And the problem is, too, that the recruiting is a huge issue. They make no effort to enhance recruiting, no effort to change their message, no effort to enhance it. And therefore, they're happy with the wilting military, which is shocking when Stanley McChrystal endorses Kamala Harris. He may be best friends with General Kelly, and Kelly is definitely against him. I get it. But for him to see the foreign policy that's taken place over the last 4 years and see how inexperienced and ineffectual she is and say she's the right person, I'm blown away by that. Were you?
Yes. And I think it, to me, and not to be cheap about it, but this is the deep state at work. These are the people they are comfortable with. They are comfortable with the Democrats. Just think about it. Joe Biden, all of these things, how the FBI and the CIA helped him, right? They helped him in 2020. They continue to help him today. They knew the Hunter Biden laptop was real, but they went out and said, oh, it could be Russian disinformation. I mean, that is how you help a candidate. I mean,
yep.
In 2016, they spied on Donald Trump. Joe Biden was in the room. We don't know on how many times, but we do know on a crucial meeting of January 5th, 2017, Trump had won the meeting with Obama, Susan Rice, Joe Biden, the CIA head, and they were talking about, and James Comey, and they were talking about how Comey should brief the yep. incoming president, Donald Trump, about the Steele dossier. And that's where they dreamed up this idea of prosecuting some of the Trump people. I mean, it was all there. They were all part of it.
Michael Goodwin.
Biden was part of it.
Yep, he was. And back then he had all his brainwaves were working. Michael Goodwin, New York Post columnist. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
All right, 1-866-408-7669. We didn't even talk about the mayor who's in all this trouble. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So I've just come from visiting the border and the port of entry in Douglas. I spoke with dedicated agents from Border Patrol and customs officers who every day see the overflow of commercial traffic through the port. These men and women who work there and at other places along our southern border help keep our nation secure. And they need more resources to do their jobs, which is why we have and are in the process of investing $500 million to modernize and expand the port of entry here in Douglas.
So this is pretty amazing that she comes down and shows this level of interest 3.5 years after getting the job as border czar. Whether you want to just have her reframe it and say it's Central and South America focused. Doesn't matter. You go to the border, find out who's coming through and why. Then when they come through, you get your ideas, and then you go to Ecuador, El Salvador, or Nicaragua, or Honduras, or wherever you want to go, and then you come down with facts. But instead, you visit one country, as far as I could tell, zoomed with the others, never go to Mexico, and now have interest because you're trailing by 16 points in Arizona when it comes to who's more effectual on the border. That's why President Trump got so angry over the weekend. He said something, you know, going over the top, we're kind of used to, and of course people blow out of proportion, but it just makes no sense. And now when I come back, I'll tell you, too, and then we'll have Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann, with the Hispanic vote is going more and more towards Republicans, more and more to Trump. Why is that? They once trailed by 33 points when Senator McCain was running. Now it's down to 12.
Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Iran is constantly looking to hurt Israel, and they seem to be willing to fight to the last Hezbollah member or the last Shia militia member. Ultimately, that'll be Iran's decision to make. Their goal is to dominate that region. They seek to drive America out of the region and then destroy Israel. And so anytime the Iranian regime is on defense, it's good for the world, good for America, and good for Israel. It'll be up to the Iranians to decide what they're going to do. But I will tell you that I believe that they will find themselves in a very precarious situation if, in fact, they do escalate this on their part.
They're not capable. I don't think they're capable of holding off the IDF, who I think was wanting to do more the last time they threw 300 rockets their direction, but we did not let them. We actually, evidently, Netanyahu told Biden, I got Nasrallah, I'm going to take him out. He says, you can't, don't do that. So they had to absorb 8,000 rockets over the past year. This time, they told him when the planes were in the air, 8,000 pounds of, 80,000 pounds of weaponry blew up these bunkers and killed Nasrallah. They say his body was intact, but he wasn't. And 30 higher-ups in Hezbollah are dead. Thousands are wounded. Remember the pagers and the walkie-talkies that blew up, let alone the other ones that just flat out targeted. It is crazy, but that's what happens. How much do you think Israel should be able to take? And then as well as what's going on with Hamas, Sinwar lives because he's surrounded by hostages. Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann hears stuff like this all the time throughout his career. He conducted and coordinated Task Force Pineapple, as you know, author of a brand new book out today, out tomorrow. Nobody's Coming to Save You, and Green Beret's Guide to Getting Big Stuff, let's say, done. Colonel, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Brian.
Hey, we'll talk about your book, but your thoughts. Now we understand the IDF is starting to move through tunnels in Lebanon. Are you hearing the same thing?
Yep, hearing the same thing, and I think it stands to reason that they're going to press the fight. You know, they've really decimated the C2 structure with everything from the targeted cell phone strikes, the pager strikes and the radios, and then this hit on Nasrallah. They've really damaged the leadership structure. So it only makes sense that they're now going to press the fight and try to take advantage of that disrupted chain of command. That is the time to just move in and really get even more lethal.
Disrupted. I mean, they've taken out, it seems to be the entire upper crust of Hezbollah.
Yeah, they have. But understand, too, that there are echelons of leadership below him that will step in, that are battle-hardened and very competent. And we've seen this through all of your violent extremist organizations. You take one out, it is effective, and it's very needed. But you have a limited window when they are in disarray, and then they will reorganize. It's just the way they're. That's just the way they are.
Does it astound you the GPS they have on these leaders, the location that they have? And they, in fact, one of the people they lost, they blew up an Iranian general too, who was meeting with Nasrallah at the time. They said that they got cameras in the cars. They could read the odometers on some of these leaders. Does that astound you?
With the Israeli intelligence and special operations capability, nothing astounds me anymore. They are absolutely just the best of the best in it, and they have to be. If you think about it, Brian, I mean, think about where they are geographically and what they're dealing with. They have to be the best in the world at that, and they learn fast. That's the other thing about the Israeli military is they crystallize their learning after battles in almost near real time. Wow. And they learn quick, they evolve. And so, no, it really doesn't surprise me because they are so myopically focused on targeting these groups, and they're relentless.
And you said there are Americans in Lebanon, and they're beginning to take out the infrastructure in Lebanon because it's run by Hezbollah.
Yeah, I think this is something we really need to watch closely. I know
we have huge assets there, right?
We do, but you know, Lebanon, as they start to press the fight, Israel, you know, there's going to be massive humanitarian displacement there, and that will, I suspect, include Westerners, a large number of American civilians, some with dual citizenship. I've been talking to some guys who are connected to Pineapple and other volunteer groups inside Lebanon, and they're saying that there's going to be if this happens, there's going to be a large displacement, and we're going to have to really move heaven and earth in some cases to get people out of there.
Right, because this was years ago a great place to live. I mean, it was idyllic, and then Hezbollah came in; it became a terrorist haven. It's almost as if these people are hostage to this terror group. The same is also often said to about the Palestinians Hamas.
Yeah, I think this is a case I've always
like
tried
mobsters.
To, yeah, I've always tried to make even with Afghanistan. You know, what these Islamist violent extremist groups do is they set up shop in the most undergoverned at-risk areas they can find, like rural Afghanistan. You know, that's the perfect safe haven where the Taliban is in charge, and they can plan, project, and strike from these places with complete autonomy. And we have this sense that if we just leave them alone, they won't mess with us. But the reality is those strategic sanctuaries, you have got to absolutely carve those things out like a cancer.
Something I never thought of, but you probably did, is when Hezbollah went into Syria to save Assad, they unmasked their structure. They unmasked who's in command.
Yep.
And when these guys died, they put up these glossy bios with great details on what they did.
Yep.
And they thought, okay, how do they fight? Who takes orders from who? What weaponry do they have? Where do they get it? They basically exposed themselves when they came out, and then they wanted to be in Africa. They want to be in Iraq. But when you do that, you expose yourself instead of being this hidden clandestine group in Lebanon.
There is a meta-narrative for a global jihad. I mean, certainly bin Laden has been espousing this since before 9/11. There's been this meta-narrative, and these groups are starting to unite around this along with state actors like Iran. But here's the rub. As an unconventional warfare kind of group like ISIS that did this in Syria, Iraq, or Hezbollah, when you go to a war of movement, when you go from unconventional to conventional warfare, there's a cost in doing that, and your anonymity is the transaction that must be paid. And that's what you saw happen here on full display with the IDF.
And Nasrallah being dead. Also, we'll see what Iran – what do you think Iran is capable of?
I think they're certainly capable of more than what they're doing. And let's not forget, I think their most diabolical capability is in how they can leverage surrogates to strike abroad. And they are working much more closely with al-Qaeda than our government is recognizing.
Even though Sunni Shia.
Even though they're Sunni Shia. That dynamic has changed in the last few years, and no one's paying attention to it. But Iran is actually collaborating very heavily with a lot of these Sunni groups, to include ISIS, to include the Haqqani Network, to include al-Qaeda. And so I think if at some point, you know, they become willing to be collaborative in strikes against our homeland. And I think, in fact, we are looking at the late stages of planning for a strike right here on our own shore.
You're kidding. It's just from what's been coming through our border.
There's a lot of reporting from veterans and American intelligence operatives who left the intelligence services, who are still talking to our allies that were abandoned, that are well placed inside these terrorist organizations. And they're all saying the same thing independently, that we are in the final stages of a massive terror operation in the United States that will make 9/11 look like a dress rehearsal. And the operatives are already here. Yes, through the border, but also Haqqani, the father of suicide bombing in Afghanistan, is now the Minister of Interior. So he issues all the legal passports out of Afghanistan.
Right. Who we're still paying some money to, right?
He has a $10 million bounty on his head.
No, but we're saying that we give humanitarian aid to Afghanistan.
Close to $80 million every 10 days in U.S. tax dollars.
That is absolutely insane. Meanwhile, what's happening in North Carolina?
Well, you know, one of the things that it's still coming out, but a lot of my folks are in North Carolina right now. And, you know, Task Force Pineapple and these other veteran volunteer groups, they come together and they talk about things. And one of the things we're seeing right now is the after effects of the Hurricane Helene are massive in the Appalachian Mountains. And because the roads are cut, communications are cut, We're not getting a decent sense of what's coming out of there yet, but I think the impact of deaths and damage to property are going to be apocalyptic.
Unbelievable. That also plays into your book, Nobody's Coming to Save You, Green Bay's Guide to Getting Big Stuff Done. You got to take things into your own hands. You found that you knew that because you're in military training.
Yeah.
But what did you discover in dealing with people that you were saving that weren't in the military?
Well, here's how I would say it. It's what I learned as a young Green Beret, where some really great sergeants taught me that when you go into a place where there's low trust, nobody's coming. You've got to deal with it yourself. And a lot of what you deal with, it's not always slinging lead. It's the relationships that you build. It's how you build rapport when everybody's angry and afraid and trust is low. I call it the churn. And I think that's right where we are in today with the election, with the way things are going in the country. We are practicing tribalism in this country. And I've seen how that ends in Iraq. I've seen how that ends in Afghanistan. And what I'm telling leaders today is if you're waiting on the government to come solve your problems, you're deluded. Like, nobody's coming. But you can still get very strategic things done, just like Green Berets do. But what we've got to get back to, Brian, are these old school interpersonal skills. The way that we engage, the way that we build rapport, the way that we restore trust when it's broken, the way that we listen to the other party when the tendency is to want to swing or go coercive on them, the way that we perform as storytellers and the way that we communicate our ideas, all of those skills that our grandparents taught us, we've lost them. Green Berets know that that's the best skill you can have. That's the Lawrence of Arabia skills, and we need them back in this country, and that's what my book is about. It's like a field manual for how to use old school interpersonal skills to lead your community, reach your clients, and have political conversations even when trust is low.
And what did you learn from Operation Pineapple, or is it a matter of just implementing what you knew?
Look, it's exactly what we did in Operation Pineapple Express. People ask me, how did you do that? You didn't have any authority, you didn't have any resources or time. What we did have were relationships and old school interpersonal skills. And that's exactly what we used, even how you and I connected around this and how we told the story on the air and how we mobilized people to help. That was storytelling, right? That was storytelling in a time of high duress. Everything that we did with Pineapple was the stuff that I learned as a Green Beret to build relationships and trust when risk is low and leverage it when the stakes are high.
Well, I'm sure if you were in the mountains in North Carolina, as perilous as it is, you'd do the same thing.
You see it happening right now. You see communities coming together and helping each other. And then you also see the ones who are doing self-preservation. They're usually the ones that were socially isolated before this began. And I can't overemphasize this enough to people that are going through hard times right now with the next crisis around the corner. You build trust when risk is low. You leverage it when the stakes are high. And if you don't take the time to do that, then you're going to go through a crisis alone. And that's not a fun thing to do.
Well, a lot of people are on their phones. A lot of people have desocialized since the pandemic. And there's been a lot of people aren't back at work.
And that's what I talk about in my book to try to wake people up to that, is that I call it the trance state. When we go into these digital devices, we actually go into a trance. We're still very primal. We're a well-dressed Neanderthal, right? We don't deal well with anything other than the natural world. So when you stick your head down in that phone for 7-8 hours a day, you are completely isolating from the natural world, which means all of your social skills, they atrophy. Your ability to tell stories, your ability to listen, your ability to even non-verbally connect with another human are going out the window. And the problem with that is there's so many crises coming at us now in full speed that the social skills are actually what's going to get us through.
So, but you're not writing this book for Green Berets. You're writing this book for everyday people.
I wrote this book for everyday people who are going through the churn of division and disconnection and disengagement, and what got them here ain't going to get them there. They need a new set of social skills, because the churn that we faced in Afghanistan and Iraq, that tribal churn, it's here now.
All right. Back with more with Scott Mann. His book is now out. Is out tomorrow, right?
Out tomorrow.
Out tomorrow. Nobody's Coming to Save You, A Green Beret's Guide to Getting Big. That was SH done. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
Hey, we are back, and Scott Mann is with us. His book is coming out. It's something for your family, especially if you're not in the military. This is a guide for you. Nobody's Coming to Save You, A Green Beret's Guide to Getting Big Stuff Done, especially in critical crisis-like events. So when we see what's happening over in Israel, all we ever hear in terms of foreign policy, Scott, is let's ratchet it down. Let's get a ceasefire. Let's get back to diplomacy. Have you ever heard, and do you subscribe to, sometimes you have to escalate to de-escalate? Do you subscribe to it?
I do, especially when you're dealing with an enemy who has a narrative of wiping out the wiping you off the face of the earth or wiping out your way of life. And that's where I think the politicians are really ill-equipped to deal with this problem set, because they don't understand the meta-narrative of the enemy. You have to not just look at the capacity of your enemy. You have to look at these, at their will. What is it that they want to do? And if you look at the will of these groups, whether it's Iran as a state actor or Hezbollah, Hamas, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, they all have a narrative of a global caliphate. And if there is a global caliphate, the Western way of life cannot coexist with it. So they are going to continue to press the fight against Israel and against us until they wipe that off the map. And that is their stated objective. It's not ambiguous. It's very explicit and clear.
Right. Do you think that we have a problem with trying to give people Western values when it comes to fighting? It's like you go for the Marcus Queensberry rules and you're going against a kickboxer who's going to knock your head off.
Yeah, I think that sometimes we – I mean, I'm all about diplomacy, and I think diplomacy should – and in fact, that's a lot about what my book is about. If, you know, Green Berets, when they go into an area – they're going to make a human connection first. That's what they're going to do. Otherwise, I mean, can they shoot their way in? Absolutely. But if that's how you navigate the world, if every, you know, if your only tool's a hammer, then every problem's a nail, right? And I get that. But the reality is, when you're dealing with a bad actor, right, that is going to visit violence upon you, then you have to understand that that's a red line, and you have to apply violence, and you have to apply it as surgically as you can. And it seems to me that that's what Israel is doing. They are pressing the fight hard, but they are focusing on C2. And unfortunately, there's a lot of collateral damage in that. It's not clean. But that's the way you prosecute a war, particularly after what's happened on October 7th. When you look at the horrorism and atrocities that were committed where they lived, worked, and played, it is the only appropriate response to something like that. And I think we would have done far more.
So Joe Biden said it at the general in front of this General Assembly last week. He said, four presidents have wanted to get out of Afghanistan. I did. I feel bad for those 13 people that lost their lives. I think about them every day. He was taking a bow. And I just find that indescribably idiotic.
Yeah, I'm just so there's such a level of moral injury among the global war on terror veterans and their families, Brian, even 3+ years after the withdrawal of Afghanistan. Over 800,000 veterans from the U.S. fought in that war, and you know, we spent a large part of our life building relationships with the Afghans, and we were told that you would be Shona Bashona, shoulder to shoulder with them, and you were held to that standard, and if you didn't adhere to that standard, you were punished for that, and then the very politicians and generals and admirals who held us to that standard just walked away on it. You know, and that created a moral injury amongst the veteran population right now and their families, a violation of what we know to be true. And that is creating a tsunami of mental health right now. And I'm telling you, it's the reason that retention is low, recruiting is low, readiness is low. Young people are seeing what happened and how our veterans were treated in that moment. And they've made conscious decisions about how they're going to serve in a volunteer force. And our politicians still don't get it.
Are you surprised that there's not more talk about the recruiting deficits?
I am, and I think that a volunteer force is not an entitlement. You know, we have a volunteer force, and that is something that it has taken us decades to build. It's a national treasure, and it has to be treated with the utmost care. And one of the things that even George Washington said, that the propensity of young people to serve, and I'm paraphrasing, is directly based on how they see the public treat the veterans.
Right.
Right.
Especially afterwards.
And look at what happened with the way we left Afghanistan. Look at how the country has turned the page on this like it never even happened, like it's a ServPro commercial. And, you know, if we don't heed those lessons, then not only are we going to repeat them, they're going to play out right here on our home shores again.
And I worry we're pulling out of Iraq. And people might say, well, that's good. Not really. Last time we pulled out of Iraq, we got ISIS.
You got to understand that these terror groups set up shop in the remote places where nobody else is, and you have to go there and stay there.
Nobody's Coming to Save You is the name of the book. Go get it for you and your family, A Green Berets Guide to Getting Big Stuff Done. Scott Mann, congratulations.
Thanks, Brian.
I'll talk to you again soon, and go get it. It's out tomorrow.
News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way We have a big hour. Trey Yinks is standing by over in the Middle East somewhere, maybe Tel Aviv, maybe someplace more perilous. He's got a brand new book coming out this week called Black Saturday, an unfiltered account of the October 7th attack on Israel and the war in Gaza. And now we have a lot of chapters that have to go in for the paperback for sure. So in fact, let's bring in Trey now. Trey, welcome.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me.
First off, where are you? Are you stateside or are you still over?
Right now I'm in the Middle East, and I'll leave it at that. We'll have more tomorrow. Okay. But, you know, we're in the field and sort of gathering information as it relates to this developing story. What looks like, according to reports, is going to be a ground invasion of Lebanon.
They have tunnels, too. They're heavily tunneled, like Gaza?
Yes, they do. And actually, back in 2019, my cameraman and I, David Gamliel, we went into these tunnels, and we saw how big they are. And I've been in the tunnels underneath Gaza. The tunnels they have in Lebanon are actually larger. They are able to use more advanced equipment to dig them, and that's part of what the Israelis are trying to make sure that they don't get caught in ambushes that they saw in Gaza, but on a larger scale.
How much damage is done to that organization, Trey? I personally never thought something like this could happen. You can not only killing Nasrallah, but 30 higher-ups, 30 leaders, as well as thousands injured in the pager walkie-talkie blasts.
I mean, it's remarkable. When you think back a year ago, this was the big fear for the Israelis, that there would be a large ground operation into southern Lebanon and that they would face, you know, a lot of heavy fire and rocket fire at the same time that would overwhelm Israeli cities. The Israelis have minimized both of those threats by conducting these operations over the past several weeks, because when we talked before about the concept of war with Hezbollah in Lebanon, they were made out to be this organization that was almost unbeatable, that would overwhelm Israeli air defense, that there would be blackouts, we were told, across Israel. Hundreds of civilians would die, and the Israelis hit them hard over the past year since they got involved in the war on October 8th. But just over the past weekend, I mean, killing Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Iran's largest proxy in the Middle East, taking out, according to reports, the vast majority of the rocket and missile launching capabilities above ground. And so it's very significant what the Israelis have done. You know, around 1,000 people, according to local health officials, have died in the process, and we should note that in the course of our reporting. But this is a significant development, and it is what the Americans fear, possibly the first step toward a broader regional conflict.
True or false, they did not even inform the U.S. that they were going to take out Nasrallah with 80 tons of bombs until the planes were in the air.
Yeah, we can confirm that, and it's pretty remarkable, and it gives you a sense of the fact that there is quite a bit of trust between the Israelis and the Americans, but also a little bit of distrust. There's real concern that the calls for a ceasefire from President Biden and other top American officials are so real that they could actually get in the way of Israeli operations. And so that's part of the reason that the Israelis are very careful about what and when they share information.
Here's Tom Cotton, Cut 4.
Over the last 4 years, they've given away tens of billions of dollars in sanctions relief. They've looked the other way as Iran violates sanctions. They've continually put more pressure on Israel than they put on Iran's terrorist proxy. That's why Kamala Harris is the Ayatollah's handpicked candidate, and why the Ayatollahs are hacking into Donald Trump's campaign and trying to kill him.
So there's some stuff that you can't comment on because it's politics, but is that the perception that many Israelis have?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, the Israelis have been living this conflict for the past year. It started on October 7th with the massacre that Hamas conducted against southern Israel, and now it has expanded to multi-front. I mean, there are rockets not just coming anymore from Gaza. I mean, much of that rocket fire has stopped. Now there's still rocket fire coming from Lebanon. Over the past week, there have been two ballistic missile attacks on Israel, and those are coming from the Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen. There are proxy groups in places like Iraq and Syria that are backed by Iran, these Shia militias that are still able to target Israel. And so it's a real seven-front war for the Israelis. And their focus is on continuing this conflict while the Americans are looking for an off-ramp at all of this. And so I think the Americans and the Israelis see this situation very differently.
You know, you have a chance. I mean, it's the IDF that's bombing out the Houthi rebels who have shut down the Red Sea and are shooting at us. You know, it's the IDF that took the shot at Iran, who clearly are our number one Middle Eastern enemy in the middle and a lot of enemy to many. Give me an idea. Like, people just think Nasrallah dies, the Middle East is upset. The Syrians are not upset that Nasrallah is dead. How many nations out there, Gulf Coast nations, didn't really get along with the Hezbollah leader?
Many. And when you look at the people who were celebrating as a result of this strike that killed Nasrallah and also a deputy commander of Iran's IRGC, it's significant because Nasrallah was not just responsible for the deaths of Israelis and Americans, but also people across the region. I mean, Syrian rebels were celebrating. You saw in some cities in Syria, they were giving out candy following this. And so in a weird way, but a true way, the Israelis have done the dirty work for some other countries who saw Nasrallah also as an enemy. And that's sort of an interesting complex about this entire story.
So let's talk about your story. October 7th, what were you doing prior to that? You chronicle it in your book. You take impeccable notes along the way, not knowing this Titanic event would take place. What do you remember about that day?
On the morning of October 7th, I got a call from my producer at 7:03 in the morning and ultimately decided after speaking with my boss, Greg Heaton, that we were heading to the South, our team here in Israel, to cover what was happening. And we didn't really know what was happening at that time. We knew that there were rockets being fired into southern and central Israel. And so we did what we always do. We headed toward the Gaza border. And as we got closer and as the day went on and that morning went on, we started to realize this was not just a normal rocket attack. And so I write about that story in my new book, Black Saturday. It comes out tomorrow. And it's going to allow readers not to just get my story and what it was like for our team behind the scenes, but also the stories of police officers, of Israeli soldiers, of civilians, of hostages who were taken into Gaza and then later released as part of the November ceasefire agreement. I also interview senior Hamas officials. I also speak with Palestinian civilians. It gives people a true understanding. If you're someone who wants to know what it felt like to be in southern Israel on the morning of October 7th, or what it was like in the early days of the war between Israel and Hamas inside Gaza, this is the book. I mean, it has truly unprecedented access to what this was like in the early days of the conflict.
Trey Yingst, our guest, he's calling us from somewhere in the Middle East. Trey, now that you have such great contacts with Hamas, great contacts with Israel, great contacts with Hezbollah and many others, can you give me your perspective? What surprised Hamas about that day, and what has surprised them about the response?
I think on that day, on October 7th, you know, based on my reporting for this new book, I think they were most surprised by how far they got into Israel. I think they thought there would be a heavier Israeli response that morning. They were able to walk into dozens of areas of Israel and slaughter civilians in their homes. They overtook army bases along the border, and they did it with ease in many cases. And so I think they were surprised about how easy it was to attack Israel on that morning, how unprepared the Israelis were. And I think since then, in some ways, they've been surprised at the scale of the Israeli response, though Israeli officials will say, well, what did you expect? But I dive into that in Black Saturday, too, because, you know, this is a really complex story. And that's part of the reason that I thought it was important to speak with Palestinian civilians as well, because the Israeli response against Gaza has killed thousands of Hamas militants, but it's also killed thousands of civilians and displaced nearly the entire population of Gaza. And so I think that's been a very shocking thing for the Palestinian people. And as we look at the story moving forward, I don't think that even Hamas could have imagined on that day that this would have led to a year-long conflict that really has no end in sight. And that's the reality on the ground, Brian. There is no end in sight. And as we speak, we are in the back of an armored vehicle right now in northern Israel, reporting on the war that has erupted between Israel and Hezbollah as a result of that attack on October 7th.
And if you think would either one of those organizations, those terror organizations, like to roll back time and not do this, 8,000 rockets later, they lost their whole hierarchy, including their leader, and now the whole country's in flames, and now they might be looking at an invasion. Hamas had 28 battalions. I think they're down to one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, this was not something that helped Hamas. I mean, the majority of their leadership was also killed, like Hezbollah's. And, you know, from our mindset, when we think about this, I always ask the question, what's the reason? At the end of the day, why do this if you know you'll be destroyed? And I used to ask Hamas officials that when I would report inside Gaza before October 7th. And their answer is often just based on the concept of resistance, resisting the Israeli blockade on Gaza and what they call the occupation of the West Bank and of East Jerusalem. And, you know, part of our role as journalists is to talk to them and try to understand why they do what they do. And I think a lot of people will find that interesting in this new book because you get perspective that I don't think any other journalist on the ground in the world today is reporting. And that is the access that we have, our team on the ground in the Middle East. You know, I speak with not just Hamas officials, but also top Israeli officials. Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, the man calling the shots today about the war with Lebanon and specifically with Hezbollah, I sit down with him exclusively multiple times and interview him about October 7th and the early days of the war. So there's all this information that sort of takes the reader behind the scenes and all these questions that we had. Some of them get answered in this book.
By the way, this might be your reporting, but this is what we have. Senior U.S. officials tell Fox Israel will launch a limited ground incursion into South Lebanon. Incursion is imminent, will be smaller in scale than the 2006 and last a shorter period of time. So is that new to you?
I'm going to attribute what I know about that to that report that you just read. But I think when you and I talk tomorrow morning on Fox and Friends, we're going to have more information on that. That's okay. What I'll say for now. But look, the reality is we can tell you based on our reporting from before that there are a lot of Israeli forces in northern Israel. They are preparing if the Security Cabinet decides to launch a limited ground invasion into southern Lebanon. And the goal of such an invasion would be to remove Hezbollah positions from the border so that they can create a buffer zone and then ultimately return around tens of thousands of Israelis to their homes.
The name of the book is Black Saturday, an unfiltered account of the October 7th attack on Israel and the war in Gaza. You're going to get Trey's notes that nobody else had seen, including probably, unless you're his producer, even people at Fox. Trey, lastly, Iran has told these groups, I got your back. I'm the parent organization. I'll arm you. I'll train you. Go out and go get Israel and kill Western interests. Well, now these both their organizations have been devastated. I imagine they go, okay, Iran, watch our backs. How much pressure is on Iran to act, and what are you thinking they will do?
There's a lot of pressure on Iran because, look, the leader of their proxy, Hamas, was killed, Ismail Haniyeh, at the inauguration ceremony for Masoud Pezeshkian, the new president. They found that as quite an embarrassment. The leader of their top proxy across the Middle East, Hassan Nasrallah from Hezbollah, was also killed. And so Iran's under a lot of pressure. They have a lot of open tabs in the region, and they say they will respond. Now we'll wait and see.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pressure on him. Is it true that you're reporting the Grand Ayatollah is in hiding now, thinking he's next?
I've seen that. I've not been able to independently confirm it, but I have seen that reporting.
Trey Yinks, thanks so much. I know you got to get back out there. Stay safe. And congratulations on the book. Talk to you tomorrow about it. It's out tomorrow, right?
Yep, out tomorrow.
Black Saturday, an unfiltered account of the October 7th attack. Trey, great job. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian. And if people want to pre-order the book or order it tomorrow, FoxNewsBooks.com.
Oh, cool. Yeah, go to FoxNewsBooks.com. Don't give any royalty to Amazon. Go get them, Trey. Thank you. Back in a moment.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
On Friday, Vice President Harris traveled to the southern border where she attacked Trump for his role in preventing a congressional border deal. But it didn't look good that during her speech, 30 migrants snuck in behind her. And even worse, she handed every one of them a voter registration.
Yes, exactly. I'll tell you, I was disappointed with the cold open. I don't know what you guys thought, but, you know, they made Joe Biden, you know, obviously... Biden's done, so they made fun of him.
They did. There were some
like
good
parts. Sudeikis made fun of him when it looked like he was being eliminated in 2020. When they gave him the nomination, they told Jason Sudeikis, you can't do this anymore. They gave it to somebody else. They made him look good. Now, I would thought they were just going to make her look like doing word salads and Trump just make fun of Trump like they always do. But instead, look, I'm here. A little comment about not knowing anything or doesn't matter what my policies are. But they made Joe Biden seem crazy and then Trump seem unhinged.
Well, I did say the same thing. They would not have made Biden seem so aloof to life if he was the nominee.
Oh, yeah.
But
just
I do
walking
agree.
Back and yeah. forth, smelling or
oh, the hair. That is very funny. It was so visual. I did not pull that part that he just sort of walked like he didn't know where it's going. Just walked up to Kamala and just started like sniffing her hair. It was so awkward.
You're
going to
make her like Margaret Thatcher and Indira Gandhi. On SNL. That's not the way it used to be.
But, I mean, if you want to hear a little bit of it, here's what they did with Kamala and then Tim Walz, who Jim Gaffigan played Walz and did a good job.
He was awesome.
He did a really good job.
Right.
So if you can hear a little bit of it if you want. Cut 41.
Okay. I am so happy. happy to be campaigning in whatever swing state I'm in, which I will just refer to as Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia. Because I am going to protect your Georgia. This election is about moving forward. You see, Donald Trump is stuck in the past. But it's like I say to my husband, Doug, when he leaves his phone at the Chili's. We are not going back.
You know, Trump and Vance are weird. All right. And they want the government to control what you do in your bedroom and what books you read. You know, in Minnesota, we have a saying, mind your damn business. We also have another saying in Minnesota, my nuts froze to the park bench.
Right? They were pretty good.
Right. No, I wonder if he's going to do that at the Al Smith dinner.
That would be fantastic. Right. Well, I mean, Kamala's not going to be there.
Well,
so.
I mean, he's going to have a lot after this. You know, the hands are going to be going everywhere tomorrow night.
It's true. But so anyway, I also think the new guy they have playing Trump, it's not as nasty as it used to be. He has like a warmer feeling about it. Yeah. I mean, they lampooned Vance.
Well,
they don't...
If Alec Baldwin didn't shoot somebody, kill somebody, would still be doing it.
Yeah.
It's not like they thought, Alec, you're a little harsh.
That's true.
They did kill Vance, right?
But yeah.
FM News Talk 97.1 is where Julie's listening in St. Louis. Hey, Julie.
Hi. I have a short, sweet, and potent ad that shows Kamala on the border is a crock. He needs to take about a 20-second video of her chanting down, down with deportation and just make a commercial out of it and just run it in all the swing states.
There's a lot of stuff out there. I mean, she wants the membership. Yeah. I mean, the prisoners, transgender prisoners, we've got to pay for them, the trans out in 2019. All she talks about is pathway to citizenship. The American people have passed on that. Thanks, Julie. John, listening in California. Hey, John.
Good morning, Brian. Hey, I wanted to talk about the polling. I have too much time on my hands because I'm checking the 2020 polls. And Trump is way ahead where he was in 2020. The swing states, they're under polling them at 2.5 points in 2020. And that's what Florida was calculated into those swing states. It's not calculated into the swing state calculations now where he had a bigger lead in 2020. The national average... At the last day before the election, he was Biden was up by 7.2, and he won by 4. So I think I'm pretty confident if Trump is tying and very close in these polls, we're doing pretty good.
I know. They said that they found a new way to poll Trump more accurately. We're eventually going to find out. You know, Trump's got to make sure. Don't make any easy errors. Don't go out and say she's mentally handicapped. Don't do things like that. And just keep it on the policies.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
They're eating the dogs.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
They're eating the cats.
Meow, 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 meow.
They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
They're eating the dogs. They're eating... The cats, they're taking your pets and they're doing freak-offs. They're doing freak-offs with the dogs and they're making the geese watch. It's very sad. It's very sad. They're doing a ditty.
So that was a little from SNL and Amin.
Yeah, that song that we bumped in with is, it's going to stay in your ears, so apologies to all of our listeners, but it's very catchy. It's out there. Then that was SNL, which was just weaved in. You know, Ohio, Trump, and Diddy. We got a nice giggle in here.
Yeah, I'm disappointed in the days when they used to just make fun of Bush and Dukakis, and I don't know. I remember it clearly. That first skit they had, absolutely horrendous. Everyone was nervous. They were doing the game show. Did you see that?
I did not see the first
skit. Did you see any of this?
Hold open.
All right.
And the weekend update.
Know what happens? Right after One Nation, everyone went out.
They went out, and so they, yes, that's true. Because
maybe they watched Jimmy Fallon. And they did not watch Senate Live.
Well, as you always open up One Nation, you either go on a date early or late.
Date early or late. That's all I ask. So I'm going to share some polls because that means ratings. But I'm just very curious about this. So they did a poll. The NBC did a poll about where is the Latino vote? Where's the Hispanic vote? So 54-40, Harris has got by 14. But this is what's alarming to Democrats. In 2012, In 2016, Hillary Clinton got that vote by 38. In 2020, it was a 33-point advantage for Joe Biden. Do you believe this? Now, in terms of a breakdown this time around, gender, men, and men are tied. He is tied with Harris on the Hispanic male vote. When it comes to women, she has got a 20-point advantage. But the reason why they're panicking is because they never were this close before. Republicans have never been this close to Democrats. Now, gets better. Under 50, it's plus five for Harris. Think about that. The future of the Hispanic vote, people under 50 years old, only plus five for Harris. For a woman, for over 50, plus 57. So the older Hispanic population loves Democrats. The younger is trending more and more towards Republicans. And I would venture a guess. If you want to get Democrats to crack down on the border, if they believe that two-thirds are from Latin America and South America, that'll do it. Because now you even the potential young people coming across the border are potential voters for Republicans. So I don't know what they're doing because they're killing the country for her to wait three and three-quarter years to go down to the border, walk around by that vanity project called a wall and be right in front of it and ask people questions and try to get them more money. Why she waited 3.5 years is, to me, pure laziness. So what else can I tell you? How about this? They did a Harvard youth poll about what the next generation, how they see themselves in terms of party or belief. 18 to 24-year-olds, 22% say they're liberal. 26% say they're conservative. 48% say they're independent. Think about that. We're always under the belief that young people hate Republicans. Until you get old and have kids, that's when you like them. Not happening. But 25 to 29-year-olds in the next generation, 27% are liberal. 21% are conservative. Independents, 48%. That's what has to give Republicans a sense that maybe Trump, who people are just waiting out, really knows much more than anyone thought with his instincts. Because I remember succinctly that when the autopsy was done and Rice Priebus was presiding over it, Michael Steele drove the Republican Party into a ditch with Mitt Romney. And they said, we got to revisit how we talk about Hispanics and the wall. And they said, start being open to pathway to citizenship. Let's get the Dreamers in there. Trump came in and said, no way, build a wall. It's going to be huge. Make Mexico pay for it. And they said, we're doomed. He wins the nomination. They say, we're really screwed. He wins the general, despite all the other antics that were going on. And in 2020, he got more of the Hispanic vote. And now, if these polls are even close, he's within 14 points, which usually means really good news. About 2024, here's the president making, I think, a mistake over the weekend. Cut 13.
Joe Biden became mentally impaired. Kamala was born that way. Okay. She was born that way. And if you think about it, only a mentally disabled person could have allowed this to happen to our country. Anybody would know this.
So you talk to the Trump people and they say within minutes, Washington Post, the New York Times, MSNBC are all calling for a statement on that. So they want to do a clarification. Now, what they're trying to say is these policies are so crazy that there's got to be something wrong with her. Right. Even that's an extreme. What I just said in me, I'm just making sure that my big stories are my policies. My big stories are how I'm creeping up in every battleground state. My big stories are that the momentum has stopped. So that was a little disconcerting to see an unforced error. But you see, you don't see many unforced errors of Kamala Harris because she doesn't do anything. So that's a bigger deal. And Lindsey Graham weighed in on it, and so did other people. Here's what Tom Cotton said on this. Cut 21.
On Donald Trump's watch, and for that matter, presidents came before him, you didn't have the largest land war in Europe since World War II. You didn't have the worst slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust. You didn't have China practicing invasions of Taiwan. This all happened on Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's watch. They are, it's the worst administration on foreign policy since Jimmy Carter. Frankly, it makes Jimmy Carter look like Ronald Reagan.
And that's why when Tom Cotton, when he decides to run for president, maybe next cycle, the cycle after, he'll probably be Secretary of Defense if Trump wins. That's why he's so formidable. He could take any question and get it down to getting people to talk about what he wants to talk about. And that's why they have him out on every Sunday show. And he was my lead guest on my Saturday night show at 9 o'clock. But overall, sure, can Kamala Harris win? Absolutely, she can still win. There's no question she can still win. Do I think that J.D. Vance got a huge chance tonight to frame out Donald Trump's agenda better than he did? Yes, I think it's a huge chance. It's tomorrow night. But I just think that if you're this close, Mr. President, you're this close to making history, the biggest comeback in U.S. political history, from where you were on January 6th to where you're at today. Biggest comeback in history. Don't make your loss be from independents and undecided. Said, yeah, I was with him until he made that comment about mental ability. And that reminded me of an uncle or an aunt or a woman. What are you saying about a woman? Whatever it is. Everybody knows they'd be better for the country than her. But it's those statements that get people turned off. One thing he's got the mail vote. And if you saw the way he was greeted at Alabama, listen to this. Katie Kay hated to say this, but said this is what MSNBC, this is what Harris is struggling with. And I don't think it's because he's a woman at all. I really don't, because I think that she'd be struggling with it if she was running against Nikki Haley. Cut 18.
The real struggle for the Harris campaign is young men, older men, men of color, white men, and they are doing all they can. You can see, I think the debate next week will be really interesting to see how Tim Walz reaches out to that group.
Yeah, good luck with that. You know, because Tim Walz is the one who is for transgender bathrooms. He was for girls playing in men's sports, men playing in girls' sports that are gender confused. All this stuff. That's what turns men off, because they're parents of daughters. Who the hell says, oh, great news? By the way, I'm seeing, I think it was in Idaho, a college team refused to play against another college team because the guy had, it was a female game and they had a man on the court. I don't blame him. I don't want it. I don't want some guy who wants to be a woman pounding a ball off my daughter's head. And I interviewed someone, by the way, who got a ball off her head in high school. She said she was had concussed for 3 months. She had headaches. I know people that get concussions in various different sports, or you hit your head on a subway, whatever it is, and you're off. Especially if you hit the one, then you're so susceptible to the next. I wouldn't put him out there. But those are the things that turn off guys. I don't know if turn off men, parents, and of course, we have brothers and sisters having on down. So I think that that's the huge problem. What the president's got to do is go for women in this way. And in an intelligent way, when it comes to, I don't care what anyone told you about IVF. I'm telling you from my mouth, I am not. I'm all nothing but for it. I don't know what anyone told you when it comes to Roe v. Wade. It was bad legislation. I could tell you, Ginsburg came out. Justice Ginsburg came out and said it was bad legislation. It got overturned, returned to the states. Not anti-women. So if you could start getting some women to understand in a nice, calm fashion that you're not against them, I think it will work to their advantage. So we'll see what happens. Over the polls, a couple more came in, and they're relatively good news but nothing's decisive yet. Trump versus Harris in Michigan among registered voters, it is 48-47. Trump versus Harris in Wisconsin, 49-47. I mentioned this on TV today. I picked up the phone and I just called the Trump people without needing anything. I just said, hey, could you just tell me what's going on? What's the sense? What's your worry? What states are you happy about? What's going to worry you? And this source said to me, we're almost looking to give up on Wisconsin. And now look at this poll. So the reason why you do that is not because you think you can't win, but you have to make decisions. I need Pennsylvania more than Wisconsin. I'm going to Pennsylvania. I might have to go protect. I might have to protect Florida, which I saw one poll out was had to be worrisome to Trump fans. I can't see that happening, but you got to put some money there. So that's big news. And when it comes to issues, abortion plus 32, it was plus 32 for Harris. It's now it's plus 32 for Harris. Effective, competent, plus 17 for Harris. I think Trump could wedge some points off that. in the economy, plus 4 for Trump. That's not great. It should be much higher. Inflation, plus 9 for Trump. Border immigration, plus 13 for Trump. So these are some of the things that I think are important that talk about trends. Nothing's absolute. You're only talking about dealing with 1,000 people. For me, the biggest joke, and what aggravated Trump, where he said that Fox shouldn't be covering, but you have to, is he saw the way Biden and Harris refused to pay attention to the border. And in my view, when certain mayors like the one in New York spoke up and said, you gave me 200,000 people I can't handle, you cost me $5.5 billion I don't have. And when they said, we need some federal help, they said, no, the state helped, but the federal government didn't. And Cuomo didn't complain. Hochul didn't complain. Guess what? Mayor Adams did. Now he's under indictment that could get him 45 years in prison. I'm not a legal guy, but I'm telling you, this seems like a big reach unless they charge him with more. So this is what these types of statements, it would drives me crazy and Trump over the top. Cut 22.
So I've just come from visiting the border and the port of entry in Douglas. I spoke with dedicated agents from Border Patrol and customs officers who every day see the overflow of commercial traffic through the port. These men and women who work there and at other places along our southern border help keep our nation secure. And they need more resources to do their jobs, which is why we have and are in the process of investing $500 million to modernize and expand the port of entry here in Douglas.
Really? Now you're doing that? Now you're doing it, meeting with Border Patrol? I've always said this, and any reporter will tell you this. There's nothing better than actually talking to the people rather than reading reports. Now she feels compelled to do it. And still, it took her 70 days to go down there since she became the candidate. Who knows what she would have done. So this is what drives me crazy and shows that she's missing and her people don't get it. The American people, 60%, 58 to 60% want massive deportation, especially we start with the criminals. Got it? People that miss their court dates. Next, boom. And then we look at the people that are here, have been here for years. And maybe the Dreamers figure out in a massive bipartisan deal after they secure the border. Having said that, this shows you what they're missing. The people that told Harris to include taxing unrealized gains don't fully understand the economy of the American people. And the people that told her to say this don't fully understand where we're at right now and how bad things are. Cut 25.
We must have comprehensive immigration reform with strong border security and an earned pathway to citizenship, including for hardworking immigrants who have
here you go. A pathway to citizenship. We're not hearing it. Nobody's hearing it. The Hispanic vote is not coming your way because of it. We're done with it. You put 7.5 million, roughly 3 million gotaways, let alone the people we don't even know about. And then we have all these people from the FBI watch list, the terror watch list, all these people here, the reports that came out that were inflated because it was over 40 years, not over 4 years, that showed 100,000 murderers here in our country. And now you're thinking about pathway to citizenship. End of that, we're going to enforce our borders. And also goes to show you there's hope. Most people have sobered up and understand that America is not a racist country. Affirmative action's gone and the world is continuing to move on. DEI is falling apart and it's because it's implausible and it's not practical and the world is not falling apart. As we start to straighten out and understand that we're not anti-immigrant, it's anti-illegal immigration, we're beginning to sober up and wake up. That's why, on paper, Trump's issues of 2016 are more apt today than in 2024. Remember, people were pushing back on sanctuary cities, sanctuary states. Now, I don't know anybody who said, wow, New York's a sanctuary city. It's so great to see illegal immigrants. It's so great that ICE is not allowed to talk to prisoners who have been jailed. It's so fantastic they can't just do the same thing in Chicago and Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. Nobody feels that way. One of the first things that Trump is going to do, I think, is get rid of the sanctuary system. I hope so anyway. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Covering this election year like no other, it's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back. I was just thinking, I think it's time to know more. So let's get started. Rob Gronkowski pranked by a Fox NFL crew. So let me set the scene for you. Gronkowski, he's on the desk. It's a pregame show with Howie Long and Kurt Menefee and Terry Bradshaw and, of course, Mike Strahan. They're on there, and they pretend they have to do breaking news. And they got to break news, and they make up a name of a tight end that's suddenly going to play. And this tight end is missing two fingers. So they're going to come in, and they want the tight end, Gronkowski, to talk about this new tight end. Here's the thing. The tight end doesn't exist, and they're not in a real break. They're still in a commercial, but they told Gronkowski, we're coming back. Breaking news. We're breaking out of the commercial. Ready, go. Listen.
I just got off the phone with Mike McCarthy, and you guys know how big of a weapon Rich Russo is for that team, right?
As a tight end, they just activated him, right?
They just activated him. They didn't know if he's going to be able to play today.
Where do you list Russo as, like, among the tight ends, playing today at least?
You know, he's been out for a little bit, so he might be a little rusty coming back, but I think they're going to give him the opportunities, that's for sure. Also, they got Ferguson as well. They're going to be a 1-2 combo.
He's the only guy in the league that has two fingers missing on his right hand. That's why he's been out.
So is that going to affect him when he's catching a pass?
Yes. I don't know.
I still have all five of my fingers.
But you know what?
No, you're the tight end.
You have 10.
All 10 of my fingers.
This is a joke. Rich Russo does not play for the Dallas Cowboys.
Is that live? I was literally like, in my mind, like, I was going to say, right when it was done, I was going to say, guys, I never heard of Rich Russo.
What do you think?
It's such a great prank. You got to love it. He rolled with it. They all had fun with it. It shows they all have fun with each other.
Right. You know what also he said? He goes, I realize I'm a funny guy.
And I can roll with it.
Yeah, I can roll with it. Hey, don't forget. October 20th. It's getting late now. Peekskill, New York. BrianKilmeade.com. History, Liberty, and Laugh. VIP tickets. Some of them remain. See you there.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.